Billy grabbed her from behind, pinning her arms back. Lavella flung him off, kicking like a mule, yelling, "Fuckheads! You scum-sucking hypocrites!" One usher snagged her by the hair, and the other took her feet. She shrieked and struggled as they carried her toward the road. I followed, glancing back briefly. Barbara Daggett was obscured by the mourners who'd stood up for a better look, but I saw that Marilyn Smith was loving every trashy minute of Lavella's performance. By the time I reached Lavella, she was lying in the front seat of Billy Polo's Chevrolet, hands covering her face as she wept. The doors were open on both sides of the car, and Billy knelt by her head, shushing and soothing her, smoothing her rain-tangled hair. The two ushers exchanged a look, apparently satisfied that she was under control at that point. Billy bristled at their intrusion.
"I got her, man. Just bug off. She's cool."
Coral came around the car and stood behind him, holding the umbrella. She seemed embarrassed by Billy's behavior, uncomfortable in the presence of Lavella's excess. The three of them formed an odd unit, and I got the distinct impression that the connection between them was more recent than Billy'd led me to believe. The graveside service, I gathered, was drawing to a close. From the tent came the thin, discordant voices of the mourners as they joined in an a cappella hymn. Lavella's sobs had taken on the intensity of a child's, artless, unself-conscious. Was she truly grieving for Daggett, or was something else going on?
"What's the story, Billy?" I said.
"No story," he said gruffly.
"Something's going on. How'd she find out about his death? From you?"
Billy laid his face against her hair, ignoring me. Coral shifted her gaze to mine.
"He doesn't know anything."
"How about you, Coral? You want to talk about it?" Billy shot her a warning look, and she shook her head. Murmurs and activity from the tent. The crowd was breaking up, and people were beginning to move toward us.
"Watch your head. I'm closing the car doors," Billy said to Lavella.
He shut the door on the driver's side and moved around the front to catch the door on the passenger side. He paused with his hand on the handle, waiting for her to pull her knees up to make clearance. Idly he surveyed the mourners still huddled under the cover of the tent. As the crowd shifted, I saw his gaze flicker.
"Who's that?"
He was looking at a small group formed by Ramona Westfall, Tony, and the Smiths. The three adults were talking while Tony, his hands in his pockets, passed his shoe over the rung of a folding chair, scraping the mud from the sole. Barbara Daggett was just behind him, in conversation with someone else. I identified everyone by name. I thought Wayne was the one who seemed to hold his attention, but I wasn't positive. It might have been Marilyn.
"How come the Westfalls showed up for this?"
"Maybe the same reason you did."
"You don't know why I came," he said.
He was agitated, jingling the car keys, his gaze drifting back to the mourners.
"Maybe you'll tell me one of these days."
His smirk said, "Don't count on it." He signaled to Coral, and she got in the back seat. He got in the car and started it, pulling out then without a backwards glance. Chapter 18. Barbara Daggett invited me back to her mother's house after the funeral, but I declined. I couldn't handle another emotional circus act. After I've spent a certain amount of time in the company of others, I need an intermission anyway. I retreated to my office and sat there with the lights out. It was only 4 o'clock, but dark clouds were massing again as though for attack. I slipped my shoes off and put my feet up, clutching my jacket around me for warmth. John Daggett was in the ground now, and the world was moving on. I wondered what would happen if we left it at that. I didn't think Barbara Daggett gave a damn about seeing justice done, whatever that consisted of. I hadn't come up with much. I thought I was on the right track, but I wasn't sure I really wanted an answer to the question Daggett's death had posed. Maybe it was better to forget this one, turn it under again like topsoil, worms and all. The cops didn't consider it a homicide anyway, and I knew I could talk Barbara Daggett out of pursuing the point. What was there to be gained? I wasn't in the business of avenging Daggett's death. Then what was I uneasy about? It was the only time in recent memory that I'd wanted to drop a case. Usually I'm dogged, but this time I wanted out. I think I could have talked myself into it if nothing else had occurred. As it happened, my phone rang about 10 minutes later, nudging me into action again. I took my feet off the desk for form's sake and picked up on the first ring. "Milhone," a young-sounding man said hesitantly.
"Is this the office or an answering service?"
"The office."
"Is this Kinsey Milhone?"
"Yes, can I help you?"
"Yeah, well, my boss gave me this number."
"Mr. Donegal at the Spindrift Motel?
He said you had some questions about Friday night. I think maybe I saw that guy you were asking about."
I reached for a lined yellow pad and a pen.
"Great. I appreciate your getting in touch. Could you tell me your name first?"
"Paul Fisk," he said.
"I read in the paper some guy drowned, and it just sure seemed like an odd coincidence, but I didn't know if I should say anything or not."
"You saw him Friday night?"
"Well, I think it was him. This was about 1:45, something like that. I'm on night desk, and sometimes I step outside for some air, just to keep myself awake."
He paused, and I could hear him shift gears.
"This is confidential, isn't it?"
"Of course. Strictly between us. Why, did your girlfriend stop by or something like that?" His laugh was nervous.
"Nah, sometimes I smoke a little weed is all. Place gets boring at 2 a.m., so that's how I get through. Get loaded and watch old black-and-white movies on this little TV I got. I hope you don't have a problem with that."
"Hey, it's your business, not mine. How long have you worked at the Spindrift?"
"Just since March. It's not a great job, but I don't want to get fired. I'm trying to get myself out of debt, and I need the bucks."
"I hear you," I said. "Tell me about Friday night."
"Well, I was on the porch, and this drunk went by. It was raining pretty hard, so I didn't get a real good look at him at the time. But when I saw the news, the age and stuff seemed pretty close."
"Did you see the picture of him by any chance?"
"Just a glimpse on TV, but I wasn't paying much attention, so I couldn't say for sure it was him. I guess I should have called the cops, but I didn't have anything much to report, and I was afraid it had come out about the... about that other stuff."
"What was he doing, the drunk?"
"Nothing much. It was him and this girl. She had him by the arm, you know, kind of propped up. They were laughing like crazy, wandering all over the place on account of his being so screwed up. Alcohol will do that, you know. Bad stuff.
Not like weed," he said. I bypassed the sales pitch.
"What about the woman? Did you get a good look at her?" "Not really. Not to describe."
"What about hair, clothing, things like that?"
"I noticed some. She had these real spiky heels and a raincoat, a skirt and, let's see, a shirt with a sweater over it, like, what do you call 'em, preppies wear."
"A crew neck?"
"Yeah, same color green as the skirt."
"You saw all that in the dark?"
"It's not that dark there," he said. "There's a street light right out in front. The two of them fell down in a heap. They were laughing so hard. She got up first and kind of looked down to see if her stockings were torn. He just lay there in a puddle on his back till she helped him up."
"Did they see you?"
"I don't think so. I was standing in the shadow of this overhang, keeping out of the wet. I never saw him look my way."
"What happened after the fall?"
"They just went on toward the marina."
"Did you hear them say anything?"
"Not really. It sounded like she was teasing him about falling down. But other than that, nothing in particular."
"Could they have had a car?"
"I don't think so. Anyway, not that I saw."
"What if they'd parked it in that municipal lot across the street?"
"I guess they could have, but I don't know why they'd walk to the marina in weather like that. Seems like if they had a car, it'd be easier to drive and then park it down there."
"Unless he was too drunk. He'd had his driver's license yanked, too."
"She could have driven. She was half sober, at least."
"You've got a point there," I said. "What about public transportation? Could they have come by bus or cab?"
"I guess, except the buses don't run that late. A cab, maybe. That'd make sense."
I was jotting down information as he gave it to me.
"This is great.
What's your home phone in case I need to get in touch?"
He gave me the number and then said, "I usually work 11 to 7 on weekdays."
I made a quick note. "Do you think you'd recognize the girl if you saw her again?"
"I don't know. Probably."
"Do you know who she is?"
"Not yet. I'm working on that."
"Well, I wish you luck. You think this'll help?"
"I hope so.
Thanks for calling. I really appreciate it."
Sure thing. And if you catch up with her, let me know. Maybe you can do like a police lineup or something like that.
Great, and thanks.
He clicked off, and I finished making notes, adding this information to what I had. Dinah had spotted Daggett and the girl at 2:15, and Paul Fisk's sighting placed them right on Cabana 30 minutes before. I wondered where they'd been before that. If they'd arrived by cab, had she taken one home from the marina afterward? I didn't get it. Most killers don't take taxis to and from. It isn't good criminal etiquette. I hauled out the telephone book and turned to the yellow pages to look up cab companies. Fortunately, Santa Teresa is a small town, and there aren't that many. Aside from a couple of airport and touring services, there were 6 listed. I dialed each in turn, patiently explaining who I was, and inquiring about a 2 o'clock a.m. Saturday fare with a Cabana Boulevard drop-off. I was also asking about a pickup anywhere in that vicinity sometime between 3 o'clock and 6 o'clock a.m. According to the morgue attendant, the watch Daggett had been wearing was frozen at 2:37. But anybody could have jimmied that, breaking the watch to pinpoint the time, then attaching it to his wrist before he was dumped. If she'd left the boat and swum ashore, or rowed to the wharf and abandoned it there, it was still going to take her a little time to organize herself for the cab ride home. All the previous week's trip sheets, of course, had been filed, and there were some heavy sighs and grumblings all around at the notion of having to look them up. Ron Coachella, the dispatcher for Tip Top, was the only cheerful soul in the lot, primarily because he'd done a record search for me once before with good results. I couldn't talk anyone into doing the file check right then, so I left my name and number and a promise that I'd call again.
"Whoopee-doo," said one.
While I was talking, I'd been doodling on the legal pad, running my pencil around idly so that the line formed a maze. I circled the note about the green skirt. Hadn't that old bum pulled a pair of spike heels and a green skirt out of a trash bin at the beach? I remembered his shoving discarded clothing into one of the plastic bags he kept in his shopping cart. Hers? Surely she hadn't made her way home in the buff. She did have the raincoat, but I wondered if she might have had a change of clothes stashed somewhere, too. She'd sure gone to a lot of trouble if she were setting Daggett up. This didn't look like an impulsive act, done in the heat of the moment. Had she had help? Someone who picked her up afterward? If the cab companies didn't come up with a record of a fare, I'd have to consider the possibility of an accomplice. In the meantime, I thought I'd better head down to the beach and look for my scruffy drifter friend. I'd seen him that morning near the public restrooms when I did my run. I tore the sheet off the legal pad and folded it, shoving it in my pocket as I grabbed up my handbag, locked the office, and headed down the back stairs to my car. It was now nearly 4:45, getting chillier by the minute, but at least it was dry temporarily. I cruised along Cabana, peering from my car window. There weren't many people at the beach. A couple of power walkers, a guy with a dog. The boulevard seemed deserted. I doubled back, heading toward my place, passing the wharf on the left and the string of motels across the street. Just beyond the boat launch and kiddie pool, I pulled up at a stoplight, scanning the park on the opposite corner. I could see the band shell where bums sometimes took refuge, but I didn't see any squatters. Where were all the transients? I circled back, passing the train station. It occurred to me that this was probably the bums' dinner hour. I cut over another block and a half, and sure enough, there they were, 50 or so on a quick count, lined up outside the Redemption Mission. The fellow I was looking for was near the end of the line, along with his pal. There was no sign of their shopping carts, which I thought of as a matched set of movable metal luggage, the derelict's Louis Vuitton. I slowed, looking for a place to park. The neighborhood is characterized by light industry, factory outlets, welding shops, and Quonset huts where auto body repair work is done. I found a parking spot in front of a place that made custom surfboards. I pulled in, watching in my rearview mirror until the group outside the mission had shuffled in. I locked the car then and crossed the street. The Redemption Mission looks like it's made out of papier-mâché, a 2-story oblong of fakey-looking fieldstone with ivy clinging to one end. The roofline is as crenellated as a castle's, the moat a wide band of asphalt paving. City fire codes apparently necessitated the addition of fire escapes that angle down the building now on all sides, looking somehow more perilous than the possibility of fire. The property is considered prime real estate, and I wondered who would house the poor if the bed space were bought out from under them. For most of the year, the climate in this part of California is mild enough to allow the drifters to sleep outdoors, which they seem to prefer. Seasonally, however, there are weeks of rain, even occasionally someone with a butcher knife intent on slitting their throats. The mission offers safe sleeping for the night, 3 hot meals a day, and a place to roll cigarettes out of the wind. I picked up cooking odors as I approached, bulk hamburger with chili seasoning. As usual, I couldn't remember eating lunch, and here it was nearly dinner time again. The sign outside indicated prayer services at 7 o'clock every night, and hot showers and shaves on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Saturdays. I stepped inside. The walls were painted glossy beige on top and shoe brown down below. Hand-lettered signs pointed me to the dining room and chapel on the left. I followed the low murmur of conversation and the clatter of silverware. On the right, through a doorway, I spotted the dining room. Long metal folding tables covered with paper, metal folding chairs filled with men. Nobody paid any attention to me. I could see serving plates stacked high with soft white bread, bowls of applesauce sprinkled with cinnamon, salads of iceberg lettuce that glistened with bottled dressing. The table seated 20, already bent to their evening meal of chili served over elbow macaroni. Another 15 or 20 men sat obediently in the chapel to my left, which consisted of a lectern, an old upright piano, orange-molded plastic chairs, and an imposing cross on the wall. The scruffy drifter I was looking for sat in the back row with his friend. Slogans everywhere assured me that Jesus cared, and that certainly seemed true here. What impressed me most was the fact that Redemption Mission, according to the wall signs, was supported by private donations, with little or no connection to the government.
"May I help you?"
The man who'd approached me was in his 60s, heavy-set, clean-shaven, wearing a red short-sleeved cotton shirt and baggy pants. He had one normal arm and one that ended at the elbow in a twist of flesh like the curled top of a Mr. Softy ice cream cone. I wanted to introduce myself, shaking hands, but the stump was on the right, and I didn't have the nerve.
End of Disc 4. Disc 5.
I wanted to introduce myself, shaking hands, but the stump was on the right, and I didn't have the nerve. I took out a business card instead, handing it to him. "I wonder if I might have a word with one of your clients." His beefy brow furrowed.
"What's this about?"
"Well, I think he retrieved some articles I'm looking for from a trash can at the beach. I want to find out if he still has them in his cart. It will only take a minute."
"You see him here?"
I indicated the one who interested me.
"You'll have to talk to the both of them," the man said. "Delphi's the fellow you want, but he don't talk. His buddy does all the talking. His name is Claire. I'll bring them out if you wait out there in the corridor. They got their shopping carts on the back patio." "I'd go easy about them carts. They get a mite possessive of their treasures sometimes."
I thanked him and retraced my steps, lingering in the entranceway until Delphi and Claire appeared. Delphi had shed some of his overcoats, but he wore the same dark watch cap, and his skin had the same dusky red tone. His friend Claire was tall and gaunt, with a very pink tongue that crept out of his mouth through the gap left by his missing front teeth. His hair was a silky white, rather sparse, his arms long and stringy, hands huge. Delphi made no eye contact at all, but Claire turned out to have some residual charm, left over perhaps from the days before he started to drink. I explained who I was and what I was looking for. I saw Delphi look at Claire with the haunted subservience of a dog accustomed to being hit. Claire may have been the only human being in the world who didn't frighten or abuse him, and he evidently depended on Claire to handle interactions of this kind.
"Yep, I know the ones. High heels and black suede. Green wool skirt." Delphi here was pleased. "Usually it's slim pickings around that bin. Aluminum cans is about the best you can hope for. But he got lucky, I guess."
"Does he still have the items?" The tongue crept out with a crafty life of its own, so pink it looked like Claire had been sucking red hots.
"I can ask," he said.
"Would you do that?" Claire turned to Delphi.
What do you think, Delph? Shall we give this little gal what she wants? Up to you.
Delphi gave no evidence whatever of hearing, absorbing, or assenting. Claire waited a decent interval.
Now that's tough, Claire said to me. That was his best day, and he likes that green skirt.
I could reimburse him, I said tentatively. I didn't want to insult these guys. Out came the tongue like some shy creature peering from its lair. Delphi's hearing seemed to improve. He shifted slightly. I left Claire to translate this movement into dollars and cents.
20 might cover it, Claire said at length.
I only had a 20 on me, but I took it out of the zippered compartment in my black handbag. I offered it to Delphi. Claire interceded.
Hold that until we've done our business. Let's step outside.
I filed after them along a short corridor to a back exit that opened on a small concrete patio, surrounded on three sides by an openwork fence made of lathing. Someone had landscaped the entire area in annuals planted in coffee cans and big industrial-sized containers that had held green beans and applesauce. Delphi stood by, looking on anxiously, while Claire pawed through one of the shopping carts. He seemed to know exactly where the shoes and skirt were located, whisking them out in no time flat. He passed them over to me, and I handed him the 20. It felt somehow like an illicit drug sale, and I had visions of them buying a jug of Mad Dog 2020 after I'd left. Claire held the bill up for Delphi to inspect. Then he glanced at me.
"Don't you worry. We'll put this in the collection plate," Claire said. "Delphi and me have give up drink."
I thought Claire seemed happier about it than Delphi did. Chapter 19. My dinner that night was cheese and crackers, with a side of chili peppers just to keep my mouth awake. I'd changed out of my all-purpose dress into a t-shirt, jeans, and fuzzy slippers. I ate sitting at my desk, with a Diet Pepsi on the rocks. I studied the skirt and shoes. I tried the right shoe on. Too wide for me. The back of the heel was scuffed, the toe narrowing to a bunion-producing point. The manufacturer's name on the inner sole had been blurred by sweat. A pair of odor-eaters wouldn't have been out of line here. The skirt was a bit more informative, size 8, a brand I'd seen at the village store and the Post and Rail. Even the lining was in good shape, though wrinkled in a manner that suggested a recent soaking. I touched my tongue to the fabric. Salt. I checked the inseam pockets, which were empty. No cleaner's marks. I thought about the women connected, even peripherally, with Daggett's death. The skirt might fit any one of them, except for Barbara Daggett, maybe, who was big-boned and didn't seem like the type for the preppy look, especially in green. Ramona Westfall was a good candidate. Marilyn Smith, perhaps. Lavella Daggett or Billy's sister Coral could probably both wear an 8, but the style seemed wrong, unless the outfit had been lifted from a Salvation Army donation box. Maybe in the morning I'd stop by a couple of clothing stores and see if any of the sales clerks recognized the skirt. Fat chance, I thought. A better plan would be to show it along with the shoes to all 5 women and see if anyone would admit ownership. Unlikely under the circumstances. Too bad I couldn't do a little breaking and entering. The matching green sweater might come to light in someone's dresser drawer. I padded into the kitchen and rinsed my plate. Eating alone is one of the few drawbacks to single life. I've read those articles that claim you should prepare food just as carefully for yourself as you would for company, which is why I do cheese and crackers. I don't cook. My notion of setting an elegant table is you don't leave the knife sticking out of the mayonnaise jar. Since I usually work while I eat, there isn't any point in candlelight. If I'm not working, I have Time magazine propped up against a stack of files, and I read it back to front as I munch, starting with the sections on books and cinema, losing interest by the time I reach economy and business. At 9:02, my phone rang. It was the night dispatcher for Tip Top Cab Company, a fellow who identified himself as Chuck. I could hear the two-way radio squawking in the background.
"I got this note from Ron says to call you," said he. "He pulled the trip sheets for last Friday night and said to give you the information you were asking about, but I'm not really sure what you want."
I filled him in and waited briefly while he ran his eye down the sheet.
"Oh, yeah, I guess this is it. He's got it circled right here. It was my fare. That's probably why he asked me to call. Friday night, 1:23. Well, you'd call that early Saturday. I dropped a couple off at State and Cabana, man and a woman. I figured they were booked into a motel down there.
I've heard the man was drunk.
Oh, yeah, very. Looked like she'd been drinking, too, but not like him. He was a mess. I mean, this guy smelled to high heaven. Stunk up the whole back seat, and I got a pretty fair tolerance for that kind of thing.
What about her? Can you tell me anything?
Can't help you on that. It was late and dark and raining to beat the band. I just took 'em where they said.
Did you talk to them?
Nope. I'm not the kind of cabbie engages in small talk with a fare. Most people aren't interested, and I get sick of repeating myself. Politics, weather, baseball scores, it's all bull. They don't want to talk to me, and I don't want to talk to them. I mean, if they ask me something, I'm polite, don't get me wrong, but I can't manufacture chit-chat to save my neck.
What about the two of them? They talk to each other?
Who knows? I tuned them out.
God, this was no help at all. You remember anything else?
Not offhand. I'll give it some thought, but it wasn't any big deal. Sorry I can't be a help.
Well, at least you've verified a hunch of mine, and I appreciate that. Thanks for your time.
No problem.
Oh, one more thing. Where'd the fare originate?
Now that I got. You know that sleazeball bar on Milagro? That place. I picked him up at the hub.
I sat and stared at the phone for a moment after he hung up. I felt like I was running a reel of film backwards, frame by frame. Daggett left the hub Friday night in the company of a blonde. They apparently had a lot of drinks, a lot of laughs, staggered around in the rain together, fell down, and picked themselves up again. And little by little, block by block, she was steering him toward the marina, herding him toward the boat, guiding him out into the harbor on the last short ride of his life. She must have had a heart of stone and steadier nerves than mine. I made some quick notes and tossed the index cards in the top drawer of my desk. I kicked off my slippers and laced up my tennies, then pulled on a sweatshirt. I snatched up the skirt and shoes, my handbag, and car keys, and locked up, heading out to the VW. I'd start with Coral first. Maybe she'd know if Lavella was still in town. I was remembering now the fragment of conversation I'd overheard the night I eavesdropped on Billy and Coral. She'd been talking to Billy then about some woman. I couldn't remember exactly what she'd said, but I did remember that. Maybe Coral had seen the woman I was looking for. When I reached the trailer park, I found the trailer dimly lighted, as if someone had gone out and left a lamp burning to keep the burglars at bay. Billy's Chevrolet was in the carport, the hood cold to the touch. I knocked on the door. After a moment, I heard footsteps bumping toward the front.
"Yeah?"
Billy's muffled voice came through the door.
"It's Kinsey," I said. "Is Coral there?" "Uh-uh. She's at work."
"Can I talk to you?"
He hesitated. "About what?"
"Friday night. It won't take long."
There was a pause. "Wait a sec. Let me throw some clothes on."
Moments later, he opened the door and let me in. He had pulled on a pair of jeans. Aside from that, he was barefoot and naked to the waist. His dark hair was tousled. He looked like he hadn't worked out recently, but his arms and chest were still well developed, overlaid by a fine mat of dark hair. The trailer was disordered, newspapers, magazines, dinner dishes for two still out on the table, the counters covered with canned goods, cracker boxes, bags of flour, sugar, and cornmeal. There wasn't a clear surface anywhere, and no place to sit. The air was dense, smelling faintly of fresh cigarette smoke. "Sorry to disturb you," I said. He looked like he'd been screwing his brains out, and I wondered who was in the bedroom.
"You have company?"
He glanced toward the rear, his dimples surfacing.
"No, I don't. Why, are you interested?"
I smiled and shook my head, at the same time caught up in a flash fantasy of me and Billy Polo tangled up in sheets that smelled like him, musky and warm. His skin exuded a masculine perfume that conjured up images of all the trashy things we might do if the barriers went down. I kept my expression neutral, but I could feel my face tint with pink. "I have some questions I was hoping Coral might help me with."
"So you said. Try the hub. She'll be there till closing time."
I laid the skirt and shoes across the television set, which was the only bare surface I could find.
"Do you know if these are hers?"
He glanced at the items, too canny to bite.
"Where'd you get 'em?"
"A friend of a friend. I thought you might know whose they were.
I thought this was supposed to be about Friday night.
It is. I talked to a cabbie who picked Daggett up at the hub Friday night and dropped him off down near the wharf.
I'll bite. So what?
A blonde was with him. The cabbie took them both. I figure she met him at the hub, so I thought Coral might have had a look at her.
Billy knew something. I could see it in his face. He was processing the information, trying to decide what it meant. I was getting impatient.
God damn it, Billy, level with me.
I am.
No, you're not. You've been lying to me since the first time you ever opened your mouth.
I have not, he said hotly. Name one thing.
Let's start with Doug Polakowski. What's your relation to him, brother?
He was silent. I stared at him, waiting him out.
Half-brother, he said grudgingly. Go on.
His tone of voice dropped, apparently with embarrassment.
My mom and dad split up, but they were still legally married when she got pregnant by somebody else. I was 10 and I hated the whole idea. I started getting in trouble right about then, so I spent half my time in juvenile hall anyway, which suited me just fine. She finally had me declared a, what do you call 'em? An out-of-control minor? Yeah, one of them. Big deal. I didn't give a fat rat's ass. Let her dump us. Let her have a bunch more kids. She didn't have any more sense than that, than to hell with her.
So you and Doug were never close?
Hardly. I used to see him now and then when I'd come home, but we didn't have much of a relationship.
What about you and your mother?
We're okay. I got over it some. After Doug got killed, we did better. Sometimes it happens that way.
But you must have known Daggett was responsible.
Sure I knew. Of course I did. Mom wrote and told me he was being sent up to San Luis.
At first I thought I'd get even with him, for her sake, if nothing else.
But it didn't work out like that. He was too pathetic. Know what I mean? Hell, I ended up almost feeling sorry for him. I despised him for the whiny little fucker that he was, but I couldn't leave him alone. It's like I had to torment him. I like to watch him squirm, which maybe makes me weird, but it don't make me a killer. I never murdered anybody in my life.
What about Coral? Where was she in all this?
Hey, you ask her.
Could she have been the one with Daggett that night? It sounds like Lavella to me, but I can't be sure.
Why ask me? I wasn't there.
Did Coral mention it?
I don't want to talk about this, he said irritably.
Come on, you talked to Daggett Thursday night. Did he mention this woman?
We didn't talk about women, Billy said.
He began to snap the fingers of his right hand against his left palm, making a soft, hollow pop. I could feel myself going into a terrier pup mode, worrying the issue like a rawhide bone, knotted on both ends.
He must have known who she was, I said. She didn't just materialize out of the blue. She set him up. She knew what she was doing. It must have been a very carefully thought-out plan.
The popping sound stopped, and Billy's tone took on a crafty note.
Maybe she was connected to the guys who wanted their money back, he said.
I looked at him with interest. That really hadn't occurred to me, but it didn't sound bad. Did you tip them off?
Listen, babe, I'm not a killer and I'm not a snitch. If Daggett had a beef with somebody, that was his lookout, you know?
Then what's the debate? I don't understand what you're holding back.
He sighed and ran a hand through his hair.
Lay off, okay? I don't know nothing else, so just leave it alone.
Come on, Billy, what's the rest of it? I snapped.
Oh, shit. It wasn't Thursday, he blurted out. I met Daggett Tuesday night, and that's when he asked me to help him out.
So he could hide from the guys at San Luis, I said, making sure I was following.
Well, yeah. I mean, they'd called him Monday morning, and that's why he'd hightailed it up here. We talked on the phone late Monday. He was drunk. I didn't feel like putting myself out. I just got home and I was pushed, so I said I'd meet him the next night.
At the hub?
Right.
Which is what you did, I said, easing him along.
Sure, we met and talked some. He was already in a panic, so I kind of fanned the flames, just twitting him. There's no harm in that.
Why lie about it? Why didn't you tell me this to begin with?
I was crowding him, but I thought it was time to persist.
It didn't look right somehow. I didn't want my name tied to his. Thursday night sounded better, like I wasn't all that hot to talk to him. You know, like I didn't rush right out. I can't explain it any better than that.
It was just lame enough to make sense to me. I said,
All right, I'll buy it for now. Then what?
That's all it was. That's the last I saw of him.
He came in again Friday night and Coral spotted him, so she called me. But by the time I got there, he'd left.
With the woman?
Yeah, right.
So Coral did see her?
Sure, but she didn't know who she was. She thought it was some babe hitting on him like a whore, something like that. The chick was buying him all these drinks, and Daggett was lapping him up.
Coral got kind of worried. Not that either of us really gave a shit, but you know how it is. You don't want to see a guy get taken, even if you don't like him much.
Especially if you've heard he's got $30,000 on him, right? I said.
It wasn't 30. You said so yourself. It was 25.
Billy was apparently feeling churlish now that he'd opened up.
Anyway, what are you going on and on about? I told you everything I know.
What about Coral? If you lied, maybe she's been lying, too.
She wouldn't do that.
What did she say when you got there?
The look on Billy's face altered slightly, and I thought I'd hit on something. I just didn't know what. My mind leapt ahead.
Did Coral follow them, I asked?
Of course not.
What did she say, then?
Coral wasn't feeling so hot, he replied uneasily.
So she'd what, gone home?
Not really. She was coming down with this cold, and she'd taken a cold cap. She was feeling zonked, so she went back in the office and lay down on the couch. The bartender thought she'd left. I get there, and I'm pissed because I can't find her. I can't find Daggett. I don't know what's going on. I hang around for a while, and then I come back here thinking she's home. Only she's not. It was a fuck-up, that's all. She was at the hub the whole time.
What time did she get home?
I don't know, late, 3 o'clock. She had to wait till the owner closed out the register, and then he only gave her a lift part way, so she had to walk 6 blocks in the rain. She's been sick as a dog ever since.
I stared at him, blinking, while the wheels went round and round. I was picturing her at the wharf with Daggett, and the fit was nice.
Why look at me like that, he said.
Let me say this. I'm just thinking out loud, I said. It could have been Coral, couldn't it? The blonde who left the hub with him? That's what's been worrying you all this time.
No, no way, he said.
His eyes had settled on me with fascination. He didn't like the line I was taking, but he'd probably thought about it himself. You only have her word for the fact that this other woman even exists, I said.
The cabbie saw her.
But it could have been Coral. She might have been the one buying Daggett all those drinks. He knew who she was, and he trusted her, too, because of you. She could have called the cab and then left with him. Maybe the reason the bartender thought she was gone was because he saw her leave.
Get the hell out of here, Billy whispered.
His face had darkened, and I saw his muscles tense. I'd been so caught up in my own speculation I hadn't been paying attention to the effect on him. I picked up the skirt and shoes, keeping an eye on him while I edged toward the door. He leaned over and opened it for me abruptly. I had barely cleared the steps when the door slammed behind me hard. He shoved the curtain aside, staring at me belligerently as I backed out of the carport. The minute the curtain dropped, I cut around to the trailer window where I'd spied on him before. The louvers were closed, but the curtain on that side gaped open enough to allow me a truncated view. Billy had sunk down on the couch with his head in his hands. He looked up. The woman who'd been in the back bedroom had now emerged, and she leaned against the wall while she lit another cigarette. I could see a portion of her heavy thighs and the hem of a shorty nightgown in pale yellow nylon. Like a drowning man, Billy reached for her and pulled her close, burying his face between her breasts. Lavella. He began to nuzzle at her nipples through the nylon top, making wet spots. She stared down at him with that look new mothers have when they suckle an infant in public. Lazily, she leaned over and stubbed out her cigarette on a dinner plate, then wound her fingers into his hair. He grabbed her at the knees and lowered her to the floor, pushing her gown up around her waist. Down, down, down he went. I headed over to the hub. Chapter 20. It looked like another slow night at the hub. The rain had picked up again and business was off. The roof was leaking in two places, and someone had put out galvanized pails to catch the drips. One on the bar, one by the ladies' room. The place, at its best, was populated by neighborhood drinkers, old women with fat ankles and heavy sweaters who started at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and consumed beer steadily until closing time. Men with nasal voices and grating laughs, whose noses were bulbous and sunburned from alcohol.
The pool players were usually young Mexicans who smoked until their teeth turned yellow and squabbled among themselves like pups. That night the pool room was deserted and the green felt tabletop seemed to glow as though lighted from within. I counted 4 customers in all, and one was asleep with his head on his arms. The jukebox was suffering from some mechanical quirk that gave the music a warbling underwater quality. I approached the bar where Coral was perched on a high-backed stool with a naugahyde top. She was wearing a western-cut shirt with a silver thread running through the brown plaid, tight jeans rolled up at the ankles, and heels with short white socks. She must have recognized me from the funeral, because when I asked if I could talk to her, she hopped down without a word and went around to the other side of the bar.
"You want something to drink?"
"A wine spritzer, thanks," I said. She poured a spritzer for me and pulled a draft beer for herself. We took a booth at the back so she could keep her eye on the clientele in case someone needed service. Up close, her hair looked so bushy and dry, I worried about spontaneous combustion. Her makeup was too harsh for her fair coloring, and her front teeth were decayed around the edges, as if she'd been eating Oreo cookies. Her cold must have been at its worst. Her forehead was lined and her eyes half-squinted, like a magazine ad for sinus medication. Her nose was so stopped up she was forced to breathe through her mouth. In spite of all that, she managed to smoke, lighting up a Virginia Slim the minute we sat down. "You should be home in bed," I said, and then wondered why I'd suggested such a thing. Billy and Lavella were currently back there, groveling around on the floor, probably causing the trailer to thump on its foundations. Who could sleep with that stuff going on? Coral put her cigarette down and took out a Kleenex to blow her nose. I've always wondered where people learn their nose-blowing techniques. She favored the double-digit method, placing a tissue over her hands, sticking the knuckles on both index fingers up her nostrils, rotating them vigorously after each honk. I kept my eyes averted until she was done, wondering idly if she was aware of Lavella's current whereabouts. "What's the story on Lavella? She seemed distraught at the funeral." Coral paused in her endeavors and looked at me. Belatedly, I realized she probably didn't know what the word distraught meant. I could see her put the definition together. "She's fine. She had no idea they weren't legally married to each other. That's why she fell apart. Freaked her out." She gave her nose a final roto-rooting and took up her cigarette again with a sniff. "You'd think she'd be relieved," I said. "From what I hear, he beat the shit out of her."
"Not at first. She was crazy about him when he first got out. Still is, actually."
"That's probably why she called him the world's biggest asshole at the funeral," I remarked. Coral looked at me for a moment and then shrugged noncommittally. She was smarter than Billy, but not by much. I had the same feeling here that I'd had with him. I was tapping into a matter they'd hoped to bury, but I didn't know enough to pursue the point. I tried fishing. "I thought Lavella and Billy had a thing at one time."
"Years ago, when she was 17. Doesn't count for shit."
"She told me Billy set her up with Daggett."
"Yeah, more or less. He talked to Daggett about her, and Daggett wrote and asked if they could be pen pals."
"Too bad he never mentioned his wife," I said.
"I do want to talk to Lavella, so when you see her, please tell her to get in touch."
I gave her a business card with my office number on it, which she acknowledged with a shrug.
"I won't see Lavella," she said.
"That's what you think," said I. Coral's attention strayed to the bartender, who was holding a finger aloft.
"Hang on."
She crossed to the bar, where she picked up a couple of mixed drinks and delivered them to the one other table that was occupied. I tried to picture her flipping Daggett backwards out of a rowboat, but I couldn't quite make it stick. She fit the description, but there was something missing. When she got back to the booth, I held up the high heels. "These yours?"
"I don't wear suede," she said flatly.
I loved it, like suede was against her personal dress code.
"What about the skirt?"
She took a final drag of the cigarette and crushed it in the metal ashtray, blowing out a mouthful of smoke.
"Nope. Whose is it?"
"I think the blonde who killed Daggett wore it Friday night. Billy says she picked him up in here." Belatedly, she focused on the skirt.
"Yeah, that's right. I saw her," she said as if cued.
"Does this look like the skirt she wore?"
"It could be."
"You know who she is?"
"Uh-uh."
I don't mean to be rude about this, Coral, but I could use a little help. We're talking murder.
I've been all tore up about it, too, she said, bored.
Don't you give a shit about any of this?
Are you kidding? Why should I care about Daggett? He was scum.
What about the blonde? Do you remember anything about her? Coral shook another cigarette out of the pack.
Why don't you give it a rest, kid? You don't have the right to ask any of us this shit. You're not a cop.
I can ask anything I want, I said mildly. I can't force you to answer, but I can always ask.
She stirred with agitation, shifting in her seat. Know what? I don't like you, she said. People like you make me sick.
Oh, really? People like what?
She took her time extracting a paper match from a packet, scratching the tip across the striking area until it flared. She lit her cigarette. The match made a tiny tinking sound when she dropped it in the ashtray. She rested her chin on her palm and smiled at me unpleasantly. I wanted her to get her teeth fixed so she'd be prettier.
I bet you've had it real easy, haven't you? She said, her voice heavy with sarcasm. Extremely.
Nice white-collar middle-class home. The whole mommy-hubby trip. Bet you had little brothers and sisters. Nice little fluffy white dog.
This is amazing, I said.
Two cars, maybe a cleaning woman once a week. I never went to college. I never had a daddy giving me all the advantages.
Well, that explains it then, I said. I did meet your mom, you know. She looks like someone who's worked hard all her life. Too bad you don't appreciate the effort she made in your behalf.
What effort? She works in a supermarket checkout line, Coral said.
Oh, I see. You think she should do something classy like you.
I'm sure not going to do this for life, if that's what you think.
What happened to your father? Where was he in all this?
Who knows? He bugged out a long time ago.
Leaving her with kids to raise by herself?
Skip it. I don't even know why I brought it up. Maybe you should get to the point and let me get back to work.
Tell me about Doug.
None of your business. She slid out of the booth.
Time's up, she said, and walked away. God, and here I was being friendly. I picked up the shoes and skirt and dropped a couple of bucks on the table. I moved to the entranceway, pausing in the shelter of the doorway before I stepped out into the rain. It was 10:17 and there was no traffic on Milagro. The street was shiny black, and the rain, as it struck the pavement, made a noise like bacon sizzling in a pan. A mist drifted up from the manhole covers that dotted the block, and the gutters gushed in a widening stream where water boiled back out of the storm drains. I was restless, not ready to pack it in for the night. I thought about stopping by Rosie's, but it would probably look just like the hub, smoky, drab, depressing. At least the air outside, though chilly, had the sweet, flowery scent of wet concrete. I started the car and did a U-turn, heading toward the beach, my windshield stippled with rain. At Cabana, I turned right, driving along the boulevard. On my left, even without a moon visible, the surf churned with a dull gray glow, folding back on itself with a thundering monotony. Out in the ocean, I could see the lights on the oil derricks winking through the mist. I'd pulled up at a stoplight when I heard a car horn toot behind me. I checked my rearview mirror. A little red Honda was pulling over into the lane to my right. It was Jonah, apparently heading home just as I was. He made a cranking motion. I leaned over and rolled the window down on the passenger side.
Can I buy you a drink?
Sure, where? He pointed at the crow's nest to his right, a restaurant with exterior lights still burning. The light changed and he took off. I followed, pulling into the lot behind him. We parked side by side. He got out first, hunching against the rain while he opened an umbrella and came around to my door. We huddled together and puddle-hopped our way to the front entrance. He held the door and I ducked inside, holding it for him then while he lowered the umbrella and gave it a quick shake. The interior of the crow's nest was done in a half-hearted nautical theme, which consisted primarily of fishing nets and rigging draped along the rafters and mariner's charts sealed into the tabletops under a half-inch of polyurethane. The restaurant section was closed, but the bar seemed to be doing all right. I could see maybe 10 tables occupied. The level of conversation was low, and the lighting was discreet, augmented by fat round jars where candles glowed through orange glass. Jonah steered us past a small den.